Good evening, and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I am Chisako Res, Chair of the Club's Science and Technology Member-Led Forum, and your chair for today. We welcome our listening audience also, and we invite everyone to visit us online at www.commonwealthclub.org. And now it is my pleasure to introduce our distinguished speaker. Dr. James Lovelock is a legendary earth scientist and the originator of the Gaia hypothesis, now the Gaia theory. The Gaia theory holds that the earth system can be viewed physiologically as one capable of self-regulating in order to survive. Dr. Lovelock's contribution to science and to our understanding of the Earth include over 200 scientific papers, as well as 6 books detailing his revolutionary insights. Later this year, Dr. Lovelock is slated to board Sir Richard Branson's Virgin Galactic space line as one of the first civilians to view the Earth from outer space. A fellow of the Royal Society since 1974, Dr. Lovelock has earned numerous accolades and awards over the years, including the Wollaston Medal of the Geological Society in 2006, the medal that Charles Darwin received in 1859. In September 2005, Prospect magazine named Dr. Lovelock as one of the world's top 100 global public intellectuals. Her Majesty the Queen appointed him a commander in the Order of the British Empire in 1990 and a Companion of Honor in 2003. Dr. Lovelock's formative years in science were spent at the National Institute for Medical Research in London and at Baylor College of Medicine in Houston, Texas. He was a visiting fellow at Harvard and Yale universities in the 1950s. Since 1994, Dr. Lovelock has been an honorary visiting fellow of Green College at the University of Oxford, where he currently resides.
Distinguished persons, ladies and gentlemen, first I'd like to thank Chisako Res for her very generous introduction, and I'd also like to thank the Commonwealth Club for inviting me to give this talk today. Well, I notice outside a number of copies of my most recent book, and the first thing I want to say is that its title, The Vanishing Face of Gaia, A Final Warning, The subtitle, A Final Warning, was not mine. It was the publisher's. They love to get their word in. I don't like it one bit. It suggests I'm never going to write another book. And it's not true. The subtitle I wanted was Enjoy It While You Can. Anyway, to get on with the talk. Where my wife, Sandy, who's sitting in the front row, and I live in the United Kingdom, is Devonshire in the far west. And it's a part of our country that has suffered some miserable weather these last couple of years. I know we Brits complain about the weather all the time, but it's been unusually bad. It was so bad last summer it was impossible to swim. It was far too cold and wet. And it still seems to be continuing that way. And my climatologist friends tell me that the whole of the world cooled by about half a degree last year and doesn't seem to be warming at the moment. And there's been very little global warming as far as average temperatures goes for the last 10 years. So the question arises, is there any global warming happening? is it no more than a green nightmare and something we need no longer fret about, or we don't have to bother about our carbon footprints and so on? Well, the climate skeptics think so, and I would like to agree with them and be relaxed about climate change, but I'm afraid it's not on. It really is warming, as I will try and show you. If we want an authoritative account of climate change, of course, we always turn to the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the IPCC. And as you probably know, it's made up from over 1,000 of the world's most capable earth scientists. And their report, last report, which was issued in 2007, was so widely recognized that they were awarded, along with Al Gore, the Nobel Peace Prize. And I think that it was richly deserved reward. Importantly, the IPCC regards climate change as real and potentially deadly. And their findings, of course, as you know, are taken by world leaders as authoritative, so much so that their predictions are used to frame legislation going right to the end of this century, which is quite remarkable. And governments and the United Nations and other agencies are prepared to hold grand meetings at Kyoto, Bali, and soon Copenhagen, and then agree to enact legislation looking that far ahead. And the assumption is that global warming is so serious that massive and expensive remedial action is needed now if we're to avoid damaging climate change. Well, I think it would be wrong to take the present cool spell as indicating that the IPCC has underestimated. And I think they, instead, they have rather done the opposite. Sorry, I shouldn't have said underestimated, I should have said overestimated. They've done the opposite, and it's a consequence of them taking the human side of climate change, our pollutions, and both industrial and domestic, and neglecting the Earth's response to what we do, which is, of course, far more deadly. And that's going to be the main topic of my talk this evening. Now, the Earth does not just passively accept what we do to it. It responds to climate change, and that response is much more deadly than the additions like carbon dioxide to the atmosphere that we make. And because these responses are now happening in the deserts, in the tropical forests, and on the ocean surface, and that's the most important part of it, and, of course, in the Arctic, these are all far away from where we live in our cities. And so we don't notice what's going on to the Earth. And we may even think, if we get a cool spell, as the one I mentioned, that no global warming is happening. It certainly is happening, and it's very noticeable in these places, particularly the Arctic. I'm not alone in a grim view of our future, and it's shared by eminent scientists such as James Hansen and Stephen Schneider, who works not too far from here. You may well ask, how is it that we scientists have let this potentially disastrous future for the world steal up on us unawares? Well, there's several reasons, and I think among them is our success in solving important past problems, like that of ozone depletion. This gave us a great deal of confidence that we could tackle the much more difficult and complex problem of global warming. On a personal note, I was at a meeting in Paris about 2 years ago on global heating, and sitting next to me was in the seat in the audience was a man I thought I recognized, and he turned to me and said, "I know you, don't I? And I'm Mario Molina," of course, one of the famous three of the ozone Nobel Prizes. And I said, "Yes, I'm Jim Lovelock." And then we started talking. And Mario turned to me and said, What a pity it is that there aren't just six big industrial firms making carbon dioxide. We could solve the problem tomorrow, couldn't we? Because that was really the nature of the ozone problem. And it's poignant, I think, that it's really all of us that are doing the emissions, not just a series of companies that we can regulate. Another reason for the division of science is another reason for the failing to be aware of what was happening is the division of science into almost unconnected specialties. Climate science is almost wholly concerned with atmospheric physics and chemistry, whereas the great ecosystems of the Earth, the natural forests, the ocean surface and so on, are absolutely wholly in the province of biology. And as you well know, these two great divisions of science don't speak the same language, nor do they much speak to each other. And this has led to the deplorable state of the separation of the assessment of the Earth's health between two different international bodies, the IPCC for the physical sciences and the Millennium Ecology Assessment Commission for the biology. Well, of course, our planet isn't divided into two convenient categories. It's a single entity, and I don't think we'll ever understand it properly so long as we treat the geosphere, or look at the geosphere for the material Earth and the biosphere for life. We have to take the two together combined, otherwise we will never understand our planet. If it were just a matter of devising a common language for science, there might be by now have been an Earth system science, or what I would call a Gaian approach to climate change. But there is another division that hampers a proper understanding, and that's the old one in science, the division between theory and practice. The advent of powerful computers has made it ever easier to build apparently realistic simulations of the world and its climate and its ecosystems. And it's become all too tempting to believe that the computer model is the real world and that the hard down-to-earth effort of gathering data on a polar glacier near the North Pole or in the tropical forests is less needed. Well, it isn't, of course. We should have been warned. The first inexcusable error occurred in the 1980s when modelers of ozone depletion were so sure that their virtual worlds were real that they ignored data about the CFC abundance in the atmosphere and about ozone in the stratosphere. I know about the CFC abundance in the atmosphere because I was measuring it at the time, and they told me my measurements must be inaccurate because they didn't agree with the models, which is fighting words to an observer. And it wasn't until two scientists in Antarctica looked up into the sky with a simple handheld spectrometer that they realized there really was an ozone hole. And it took them 2 years before they would publish a paper on it because they were so sure the modelers, who are much more important scientists, must be right. And now a wholly unpredicted but equally deadly hole has appeared in the floating ice of the Arctic Ocean. It was not predicted, and the lesson still does not seem to have been learnt. In earlier times, these deficiencies would merely have been part of the natural history of science. Now they seriously interfere with our ability to understand the Earth system at a time when we really urgently need to do so. We need to understand the consequences of adding greenhouse gases to the air, and just as importantly, the consequences of removing natural forests to make farmland, because each of those acts disables the Earth system's capacity to regulate itself. We are in some ways like someone who has smoked cigarettes for 30 years and now suffers a persistent cough. It's getting rather late to do anything about it. If the climate models are unreliable, how can we be sure, how can governments be sure about the climate 10 years from now, and still less at the end of the century, I think the simple answer is that we can't be sure. The failure is so great that the IPCC is even failing to predict what is happening to the climate this very moment. This stark view was reinforced 2 years ago by the publication in Science by a number of observers of what the sea level, the surface temperature, and the carbon dioxide of the atmosphere really were, and that they were very different from the predictions by the IPCC for that time, which was then, and the same is true now. They showed that even the gloomiest of the IPCC predictions were underestimating the severity of climate change. And I can show this on a slide for you. If I can get it. Yes, it's that one in the, on the top of this screen with the blue, with the green band shown in it. And what it shows is the level of the sea, the ocean, the world ocean, because it's the same everywhere since the sea is contiguous, observed by observers by different means, some by satellites, some by shore level based observations around the world. And it's that solid line going straight line. That's the real sea rise of sea level. The green band are the IPCC predictions for the same period. And you can see how seriously in error they are. Even the most pessimistic of the IPCC's predictions is only getting it about half right. The sea is rising twice as fast as the predictions would indicate. And a point that I think you may find very useful. If you're puzzled about global warming and you really want to know what's happening, one of the best ways, I think, to find out is to go to Google or Wikipedia and look up what the sea level is. If it's still rising, then you know global warming is happening, because there's only two things make the sea level rise. One is, as it gets warmer, it expands, which is obviously a measure of the heat absorbed by the sea. And the other is, as ice melts on the land from glaciers, it flows down the rivers, the water does, and raises the sea level. And those two are valid measures of the amount of heat, extra heat, the Earth is receiving. So sea level is the sort of gold standard for you can use for seeing what sort of global warming is happening. Now, I mentioned the hole in the ice, and I have a picture of it here. If I can get the slide. Yes, there's that one on there. Now, this, the dark line sort of running through the slide is the average of a lot of observations of the area, or the extra area of ice that's melted during the summer season in the polar ocean. And at first you can see that through the years going on from, I think it's, I can't see the chart from here, but perhaps you can. I think it's somewhere in the 1980s. At first there was very little extra ice melted in the summer as time went by. But quite suddenly, round about the middle of the 90s, it started to increase. And in recent years, especially 2007, it's diving right the way down, so that in 2007 only 40% of the ice of the around the North Polar Ocean was left at the end of the summer, which is a huge change. Observers reckon that within 5 to 20 or 30 years all of it will be gone in the summertime, and if you're so inclined you'll be able to take a sailboat to the North Pole in August or September of the year that it happens. Now, this is deadly serious, because you can do a back-of-the-envelope calculation. White ice reflects 80% of sunlight back to space, whereas dark ocean absorbs 80% of sunlight that falls on it. And the difference between these two means an additional heat load to the Earth when all that ice is melted, which is equal to all of the CO2 we've added to date. So we can see it, global warming will be doubled just by the increase of that amount of ice. Climate scientists have been obliged to reduce their vision of the Earth to something that they can manage. I mean, as a practicing scientist myself, I know this limitation only too well. And so far, they've only had time to come to terms with the gases of the air. They know that the oceans are important in the climate, and so are the clouds, and so are the surface ecosystems. But they're only partly understood, and they don't yet know how to incorporate them properly into the models like those of the IPCC. So we're really modelling the future on it far from complete data. The biosphere's response to what we do is completely unknown and not put in the models at all. Now, for the past 40 years, I've worked on a different way of looking at the Earth, seeing it as a dynamic system that includes an active and responsive biosphere. To use it means turning away from established science of the past centuries and then seeing our planet as a new and incompletely understood form of life, if you like. If we do this, surprisingly, it becomes easier to understand, not more difficult, and more predictable. It was a surprise to me to find that this simplification was first suggested by the eminent American scientist Alfred Lotka as long ago as 1925. He said back then they will try to understand the evolution of life on the Earth and the evolution of the Earth itself as two separate subjects. I think this is a mistake. They should be considered as a single subject, and they would find it, if they did, simpler, not more complicated than either alone. Well, as you know, the study of the evolution of life by itself alone led to the discovery of deterministic chaos, hardly what was expected, because the real world is not chaotic. We know that the Earth is a dynamic system of extraordinary complexity, but we also know that the same is true of one of us. And we're far less baffled by the response of one of our friends or family members to a change in temperature than we are to the response of the Earth. This is because we see a friend as a whole person and not as an incredible collection of billions of living cells in dynamic cooperation. Climate scientists think of the Earth as a collection of separate parts, not as a whole live planet. And this is why I think they find it so dauntingly complex. They will remain unable to forecast future climates until they model the Earth as a single system able to respond and evolve when the climate or atmospheric gases change. And it is true that the IPCC includes parts of the biosphere in their models, but they include life as a static entity, rather as a passenger on a ship, rather than a member of a working crew. It's possible to make a simple model of the Earth using Gaia's theory, and I made one in 1994, and it was published in the peer-reviewed journal Nature. What I did was to imagine a simple planet that orbited a star like our own sun, and it had plants on the land, algae living in the oceans, and consumers that ate both of them and returned the CO2 that was pumped down by the plants and algae to the atmosphere and so kept the balance of nature. The effect of temperature on the growth rate of plants and algae was taken from real Earth observations in this model, and the climate was calculated simply from the established equations of geophysics, and the regulation of temperature took place as the level of CO2 was changed in the model in the same way that we are doing to our planet now. It's important to realize that this is both a climate model and a population biology model. The two are combined, as Alfred Lotka suggested. And I can show you a comparison of the predictions of this simple model with those of the IPCC, if I can find it here. Yeah, that's the one. Now, the thick solid line there is the average of the best of the IPCC predictions and taken from the journal Nature from about 2 years ago. And as you can see, the temperature stayed more or less constant up until somewhere, it goes from, when is it, 1900 to about 2000. And then it's, since then, it's predicted to rise steadily. And by the end of the century, be 6 degrees or even more warmer than it is now. That's the IPCC prediction. And it's just as well they don't predict on beyond 2100 because it will be going out through the roof by then, as far as one can see. Now, the grey line on there, the fainter line, are the predictions of this simple model I mentioned. And in the simple model, the seasonal fluctuations of input of heat to the planet were also included, and that's why the graph shows fluctuations occurring in the predicted temperature. You will see it's interesting to note that as we move on towards the present century, the amplitude of those fluctuations increases steadily due to positive feedback, the Earth acting as an amplifier, which it is, and then quite suddenly there's a jump to a new steady state. And in the new steady state, the amplitude of the fluctuations is reduced as negative feedback takes full charge again and regulates the fluctuations of the planet. That, I think, is closer to what the Earth's history shows happens to our planet when it experiences warming from any cause, whether it's the addition of CO2 or the increase in solar input. As happens at the end of an ice age, for example. And talking of the end of an ice age, I've got one more graph here I'd like to show you that I think it's this one. Yes. This one shows you how the temperature changed at the end of the last ice age. It goes from 15,000 years ago up until recent times. And it's interesting how similar this is to the simple model prediction. You have a series of oscillations at first, quite sizable, then a drop in temperature right down to quite low temperatures, and then quite suddenly a very precipitous rise to the temperatures of the interglacial, the more or less the present before we started warming, which are steady and more or less regulated. And this picture is much more like the kind of response of the planet than predicted by the IPCC models, which are purely geophysical and don't include the biota. Excuse me. I find it extraordinary that climate scientists could have put their names to predictions as far ahead as the end of the century and in the face of such great uncertainties. Now, I know personally scientists of the IPCC, and some of them are friends of mine, and I know that they're wise, competent, and principled. So what on earth made them persist with what may be the wrong kind of climate model and assume that their forecasts were good enough for governments to actually issue policy on them, looking tens of years into the future? One answer may be that they had no option. Having persuaded governments that large, expensive modelling centres with huge supercomputers and all of the acolytes to run them were needed, you could look at them as the battleships of the climate war, they just had to sail in them and hope for the best. You could hardly go and say, no, we've got the wrong equipment, we need something new. Governments and research agencies, on the other hand, have a strong tendency to cut back funds for observations I think it was the Keelings who experienced the ignominious response from Congress, that what on earth was the point of their measuring CO2 on in Hawaii, since we now knew the amount, why did they want funds to continue measuring it? that's the typical government response, and our government in Britain is just as bad. And I often wonder what a modern grant funding agency would have done in the 19th century about funding a graduate student called Charles Darwin, who merely wished to sail around the world on a ship for 3 years and hope to find something interesting. I'm fairly sure he wouldn't have got his funds. So what can we do? Of course, we have to stop as much as we can burning fossil fuel at an excessive rate, and equally importantly, reduce the area of the natural world we use for ourselves if we can. But our main task, I think, should global heating continue, is to adapt and prepare to survive. The Earth system Gaia has survived far worse insults than industrialized humans, and almost certainly will save itself. And it's absolute hubris to imagine that we can save the planet. It's much more important that we save ourselves. We're a tough species, and we've survived 7 major climate crises in the past million years. Crises just like that one there, where the temperature shift is about the same as the one due up ahead in perhaps in this century. We've survived those, and we're here today talking about it. But so we are most unlikely to be made extinct by global heating, but we may be cut back to a billion or less. We have to survive global heating and hope that the stresses it imposes will encourage the evolution of a more capable form of humanity. We have truly to concentrate on saving ourselves. Does it mean that there is little we can do to prevent the Earth system from moving to the stable hot state? Perhaps it does, but in no way do I mean that there is nothing that we can do. There's been a lot of talk recently of geoengineering, and I don't want to go too deeply into that because it's a subject of its own, but I will say that there are possibilities in geoengineering of buying us time, and we do need time, but in reality, if you look at geoengineering, most of the proposals really are for a temporary cure. A bit like if your kidneys fail, you can go on dialysis. It's not a cure for the problem, but it does give you a few years more life. And who would refuse it if death was the alternative? There is one possible way that if we can get our act together, might take the CO2 out of the air and bring us back to where we were. And that's the process of using the biosphere itself to do the pumping for us. You see, the biosphere pumps 550,000 million tons of CO2 from the air every year. We are only emitting about 33,000 million tons, a small proportion of the total turnover of the whole system. So if we could persuade the biosphere not to immediately return that CO2 as it does now, as we eat the plants and microbes eat them and animals eat them and so on, if we could persuade it to halt that process, then we could take out CO2 fairly promptly and do quite a good job. And the one way you can do it is to persuade farmers everywhere to turn their agricultural waste, the stalks and the leaves of their plants, not the food grain, into charcoal. And this suggestion was made by Johannes Lehmann, a New York scientist, 2 or 3 years ago. I think it has an earlier provenance, but I'm not sure about that. But it may not be so difficult to do. It would really involve putting a charcoal maker on every farm, and getting a farmer to put his waste in it each year, he would get the benefit of a small yield of biofuel as a byproduct from the thing, which he could sell or use to drive his tractors with. So I think it just does have the chance of doing something serious, without the need for government subsidy, which is always a danger because it too easily then becomes a scam. Perhaps our first task, though, is to stop thinking blindly that reducing our carbon footprint is all that we have to do. It most certainly is not, and we have to understand that abrading the skin of our planet to provide farmland destroys more than 40% of the Earth's natural ecosystems, and these, of course, were what previously served to sustain a stable climate. And I think I can illustrate that point with my last slide, which is also taken from Science magazine, and it's a nice simulation of New York in 1600, before anybody went there. But it is so typical of what we've done to so much of the Earth's surface. We've taken away those wall-to-wall trees that were looking after our atmosphere and our climate and everything for us, and replaced it with man-made stuff, which is doing nothing to benefit the planet and a little to harm it. And the same is true of farmland. Nearly all of Europe, North America, Russia, China, was similar wall-to-wall forest before humans started moving in and turning it into farmland and cities. So this sort of activity is just as important as burning fossil fuels in causing our problems. Well, the present IPCC models, even though they underestimate, predict almost unanimously that by 2040, the average summer in the north temperate regions of the world will be as hot as the summer of 2003 in Europe, which was a summer when the months June, July and August ran temperatures around about 110 Fahrenheit and there was no rain. Over 30,000 people died of overheating in that summer, but much more importantly, agricultural production dropped to almost zero. And this is the rub. By 2040, we may have air conditioning everywhere, but what will we do about growing food? Without extensive irrigation, the plants will die, and both farming and natural ecosystems will be replaced by scrub and desert. The same dire changes will, of course, affect the rest of the world, and I can envisage you here in California and in much of America perhaps migrating into Canada, and the Chinese, where they will go. They can't very well go to Siberia without there being war, but they can go, and they appear to be preparing to go to Africa. But there will be mass migration, I think, around the world. Well, we may have as much as 20 years to prepare for these changes, and we can't go on burning fossil fuels, but our cities do always need abundant electricity to survive. So what can we do about it? Apart from hydroelectricity and perhaps solar thermal energy from the sunbelt states like Arizona and New Mexico, which is not yet on stream but shows a lot of promise, there isn't anything much that will supply a constant and adequate amount of energy other than nuclear energy. And I think that it's time that we admitted that the grand idea of sustainable development and renewable energy has had its time, and we've got to accept nuclear energy as the immediately available, safe, constant and reliable source of electricity. Most of all, the objections to nuclear are based on irrational fear, and this has led to unwise legal and political restrictions of its use. It needn't be looked on as a long-term solution, but it surely will get us through the next crucial 30 years or so. In France, they already are producing 80% of their electricity from nuclear. The rest is from hydroelectricity. So they're the greenest country in the world by a long, long way. Their emissions of CO2 are negligible compared with others for electricity production. And if you go there, you will find it running very comfortably on cheap electricity from that source. 55 million years ago, a similar amount of carbon dioxide was added to the air by a geological accident, and the temperature rose, as we predict, about 5 to 8 degrees Celsius. But there was no great extinction of species, and this may have been because life had time to migrate to the cooler regions of the Arctic and Antarctic and wait out the long hot spell which lasted 200,000 years and then migrate back again. And this may be happening again with humans, animals and plants already migrating to Canada, Alaska and the oceanic parts of Northern Europe and Siberia. This puts a special responsibility on all of us to stay civilized and give refuge to the unimaginably large influx of climate refugees in future. I think what we have to do is to spend our money not on vain attempts like renewable energy to put off global warming, but on preparing for the migrants. We don't want them coming into shackvilles, desperate places where disease and the death rate will spread and the death rate is high. We want a reasonable infrastructure of cities for them to live in. And this will consume an awful lot of our resources. Anyway, perhaps the saddest thing is that if we fail to do this and humans go extinct, Gaia will lose as much or more than we do. Not only will wildlife and whole ecosystems vanish, but in human civilization, our planet has a truly precious resource. We're not merely a disease, as some have suggested. We are, through our intelligence and communication, the planetary equivalent of a nervous system. We are part of the planet, and through us, it's been able for the very first time to see itself from space and see what an incredibly beautiful planet it is compared with those dreadful deserts of Mars and Venus. And what would be our fate were there not life on the Earth? So we should not feel guilty. In the Earth's history, there have been other organisms that in their early development wreaked havoc, yet in time became vital components of Gaia. Photosynthesizers that first made oxygen must have been far worse polluters than we are. You see, oxygen to a naive and unexperienced planet would have been as poisonous as chlorine would be now. And yet over the years, we've adapted to it and then made use of that reactive gas to empower animal life and even let us drive our cars. It's taken Gaia 3.5 billion years to evolve an intelligent, partly social animal species. The photosynthesizers had a long time to wait before they became redwood trees. And so we, I think, will have to be patient while we slowly evolve to become an integrated part of the first intelligent planet of our galaxy. But what a wonderful future for us that would be. Thank you.
We'd like to remind our listening audience that this is a program with the Commonwealth Club of California. And you're listening to The Vanishing Face of Gaia, A Final Warning, with Dr. James Lovelock. Our thanks to Dr. Lovelock for his comments here today. I am Chisako Res, Chair of the Club Science and Technology Member-Led Forum, and I will be moderating today's audience question period. We have quite a few questions here today. And the first one is, many feel that climate change can be tackled through miracle advances in clean technology. Is this faith misplaced? If so, how can we bring about a different way of thinking?
I think it is misplaced. I think that relatively simple actions like improving our carbon footprints, establishing sustainable development, and so on, are nice ideas, and they might have worked long ago in Malthus's time, that's 200 years ago, when he suggested there already might be too many people on the planet. But now the numbers of people living on the earth, living in the way they do, is really rather more than the planet can cope with.
Okay, thank you. The next question. Can you give us your opinion of the MIT Integrated Global Systems model? Is this better than the IPCC model?
I don't know the full details of the MIT Integrated Global System model, so I'm not really competent to comment there. But what I've heard, which is only hearsay, is that, yes, it is a better model. Yes.
All right. The third question. Can you discuss the integration of scientists with politicians and corporate leaders? How much influence do scientists have?
I fear that science has very little influence on politics at all. One of the curses of my own country is that out of 600 members of parliament, I think there is only one or two who are engineers, and as far as I know, none who are scientists. The last prominent scientist of any name we had in our government was Margaret Thatcher when she was Prime Minister. She was a PhD chemist. Mm-hmm. And I don't know about America. I can't say, but I suspect that Congress does not contain many scientists.
All right. Thank you. Where do you recommend people buy real estate?
Well, that's a fascinating question. I gave a talk not too different from this at Stanford about 3 years ago, I think it was. And afterwards, the students came up to me and said, I say, Professor, where do you reckon we should be buying real estate in Canada? But that wasn't all, because one or two of their professors came up afterwards and said, well, look, Canada's a bit far north, and I don't fancy going there in my old age. Do you think Victoria Island would hold out? The answer, of course, is yes, it would.
I read your book, and then your book mentioned that England and Japan, and some, I can't remember all the places, but you said there are certain places where global warming may not have significant effects, so people may be able to survive there. And so do you think those places may be a good place to go and purchase real estate?
No, I don't. Neither the UK nor Japan are very sensible places to go. It's, to be sure, the climate there of those island nations may not experience anywhere like as severe a change as the great continents do. But they are both already overcrowded, and they are like lifeboats that are already full. They don't grow enough food to feed themselves, either of them, so they're in danger already of having too many people on them. And they will face the awful problem of deciding who to throw overboard.
All right. Thank you. Okay, next question. What do you think of REDD, RED, Typical Forecast Determination under Kyoto? REDD?
I don't know what that is.
Who asked this question? Would you please clarify? Okay, let me get the microphone for you.
It stands for reducing deforestation, tropical forest, basically the mechanisms where they're trying to preserve tropical forests in developing countries.
I think it's an excellent notion. It's really stressing what I said earlier, namely that we have to take account of what we do with the land surface as well as what emissions we make. It's not enough merely to reduce emissions. We've got to stop taking away natural ecosystems that are doing the self-regulating just in order to produce farmland to feed ourselves, or far, far worse, growing biofuels to drive our cars. That is one of the most insane ideas I've ever come across.
Okay, thank you. Next question. Is there any noticeable or a measurable effect yet of the global economical downturn on global dimming and temperature? I guess this question addresses the fact because of the current global economic downturn that might alleviate the global warming.
That's a very interesting question, and I think the simple answer is it's too early yet to give a decent answer. And also, remember, I've said repeatedly, there aren't many people making observations, nowhere near enough. Mm-hmm. And so it may take even longer than one might think to be sure about that. But one thing to bear in mind here, and I'm very interested in this to see what happens, is I would think that if there was suddenly a great reduction in the amount of coal burnt for power production, electricity production for industry and so on, and other fuels similarly, not only would CO2 input decrease, but also the input of aerosols would decrease because there's sulfur in the coal, which produces the haze in the atmosphere that prevents it being clear. If the reduction happens, it could be that the haze would fall out within about a couple of months, but the CO2 would stay there. It wouldn't go away. In fact, it would take 100 years or more before it even started to go away, and therefore the climate would get hotter, not cooler, as a result of the recession.
Okay, good point. Interesting point. Next question. In my lecture tomorrow to our disinterested class, do you have suggestions how to make this subject relevant? Well, they should come here to listen to Dr. James Lovelock.
Yes. That's a quaint question. Yes. I don't think I can answer it. Okay. I don't know what he's going to lecture about to start with.
Yeah, would you like to... Who asked this question? Would you like to clarify your question? I'll get you the mic.
Yeah, I have class and all fun stuff.
The mic is off.
I'm teaching a class in Oakland on green remediation in the building industry, and trying to interest them in why we're doing this is sometimes hard.
So maybe
nobody believes that you know soon the shoreline is going to be around International Boulevard in Oakland.
I sympathize greatly now with your question. I see where you're coming from. I think and I hope that what I've said doesn't put people off doing ordinary sensible things, like, for example, in the building industry, improving the insulation of houses, improving their energy turnover is well worth doing because it'll save money. It'll save waste, and that alone should be a sufficient motivation. If it helps the climate as well, all well and good. But don't do it just in the hope that that'll put off global warming. It probably won't.
Thank you. Next question. I do not at all doubt the truth of climate change, but I'm personally perplexed as to why there is no evidence of a raising ocean affecting the San Francisco Bay, or is there? I don't think we have any... Do we have any observations about San Francisco Bay?
Well, we do. The first chart I showed, and I'll probably show it again. It shows the rise of sea level over the years. This affects San Francisco Bay as much as anywhere else in the world because the sea finds its level regardless. Now, it's only going up millimeters, so I don't think most people would ordinarily notice it. The danger of sea level rise is by the time it's gone up a foot, which is about the amount of the whole of that rise, it becomes significant if there's a very big storm surge. That's what floods places, not so much merely the rise itself. But if the rise is added onto, shall we say, a 10-meter wall of water that's coming inland, as did with Hurricane Katrina at New Orleans, if the sea level has risen a foot, that's serious anyway. It adds on and makes the whole effect more damaging. But I don't think you should worry too much about San Francisco Bay in the immediate future.
All right. Now, we have the last questions to accommodate for a book signing. Dr. James Lovelock kindly agreed to do some book signing for us, and the books are available outside. If you're interested in purchasing some books, Dr. Lovelock will be here to sign your book. The last question is, can the practical problem in developing nuclear power be overcome?
The which problem?
Practical problems in developing nuclear power be overcome?
I think the answer to that is quite simply, it has been overcome virtually completely by the French. And if any of you want to know, it's well worth a visit to France to have a look at it. As I mentioned, they get 80% of their electricity from nuclear and 20% from hydro. You can't do much better than that. They've solved the nuclear waste problem almost completely. All they do, and it's very simple, is to, I've seen it working, so has my wife. The French government are very good. They let you see everything that's going on in the industry. They reprocess the fuel from nuclear reactors after its use and remove all of the plutonium, which is the main source of high-level radiation, and then put it back in the next generation of fuel that's going to go in the reactors. So they get rid of their high-level waste by burning it in ordinary, regular reactors. And this works. And it works fine. The remaining high-level waste, they put into a room which is not much larger than a cinema in northern France at a place called La Hague. And it's in a hole in granite beneath the building itself. And on top of the hole is a lid of 3 meters of concrete. And we both went there and stood on it. All of 25 years of nuclear waste from the country that uses the most nuclear energy. And the radiation level with a handheld monitor, my own one, I wasn't believing anything they told me, was 25 microsieverts per hour, which I would reckon is probably slightly less than the amount in this room now. They have dealt with the problem completely. The water usage by a nuclear power station for cooling in the cooling towers and so on is no greater than that of any other power station, a coal-burning power station, oil-burning, you name it. It's certainly more than a gas turbine type of power station, but we don't always have gas available. It's not conspicuously a problem. Also, most of the French nuclear reactors are either on the coast or, as the British ones are, or near large rivers, and they do the cooling by just warming the rivers or the sea, as the case may be, and there aren't cooling towers, so the water usage is not really very conspicuous. I wouldn't think that is a major problem.
Okay. Our thanks to Dr. James Lovelock for his comments here today. We also thank our audience here, as well as those listening to the recording. And now, this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, commemorating its 106th year of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.